Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quiere meter ese balón para Saka. Vaya, qué peligro, balón. Qué control de Saka. Puede venir el segundo. Saka recorta, Saka. Gol. Gol, 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 gol del Arsenal. Gol de Bukayo Saka. 26 de partido. Tottenham 0, Arsenal 2. Tottenham 0, Arsenal 2.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunner Blog. James, goodly fucking morning to you.
Yes, goodly morning, mate. And happy St. Totteriam's Day.
See, I don't care about that. Don't care about it. We've got bigger fish to fry, yeah. Yeah, it was quite funny yesterday when I saw people saying, oh, it's St. Totteriam's Day. I was like, yeah, who cares? We've got more important things to play for than just like St. Totteriam's Day. Maybe that's me.
I hear you.
My standards are high, you know?
I felt its absence quite keenly for that horrible little period that I refuse to reflect upon.
Okay.
But yeah, I find it always a delight, and particularly to secure it at their ground as well.
Yes.
But you're right, we do have bigger fish to fry. Yeah. But I did find this very funny. The Arsenal Brisbane group on Facebook put together a St. Totteriam's Day prayer. Would you mind briefly?
Please, let's. Everybody, please kneel for the prayer.
Thank you very much.
Father James.
Our neighbours who art in shadow, fallow be thy game, thy fandom scum, thy players plums. In truth, none would make our 11. Give us this day our Champions League and forgive us for taking the piss as we laugh at those who finish behind us. And lead us not into N17, but deliver us from Levy. For Arsenal is the kingdom, the power and the gap. Forever and ever, Arsene.
Very good.
I don't know if they authored that originally, but it really made me laugh. So,
that's good.
Happy St. Totteriam's Day.
Well, happy St. Totteriam's Day. Yes, I shouldn't be so dismissive. You know, I'm tied up in this title race, this whole potential of, you know, being champions or whatever. But I did think it was quite interesting that this was a big thing to celebrate in the not-too-distant past, and the fact that we are where we are and this season is going the way that it's going, it became something of an afterthought. And I think, does anything quite sum up what St. Totteriam's Day should be about than simply an afterthought? You know?
Well, quite. I mean, it tells you where we are. And I think, am I right in saying, was it yesterday we secured Champions League qualification?
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Barely a blink of an eye. You know, didn't register, did it? Because our sights are set higher. But I think it's good to maintain that sense of perspective as well and be like, you know, there was a long period of time where we couldn't take something like that for granted. The fact we now can tells you a lot about the progress that we've made.
For sure. And look, it wasn't too long ago. What was it? A couple of years ago when, you know, things went wrong towards the end of that season, lost at Spurs, lost at Newcastle, and you know, serious pundits who are paid lots and lots of money for their opinions on the biggest broadcasters in the game were saying, well, that's it for Arsenal. This is their chance. They've had it. Tough luck. Off you go, back into wherever it is we think you're going to go to. And they could not have been more wrong about that. And they could not have been more wrong about what was going on at Arsenal, which is why we are where we are. And we can qualify for the Champions League. We can make St. Totteringham's Day happen at their ground. And everyone's like, great, but let's go for the real prize here. And I think there's a lot to take from that. And going back to the prayer from Arsenal Brisbane and what they referenced in there, despite the fact that this game made my palms sweat for the last 10 minutes, 15 minutes or whatever it was, I literally had to go to the kitchen and wash my hands when I was finished doing the live blog because I was sweating. There is a lot to enjoy and there's a lot of funny stuff in this game, and I think we should do our utmost to relive that with our listeners, because what you have to do at this point of the season is win games. And Arsenal won that game. Was it as convincing as we thought it might be at one stage? No. But ultimately, we've gone away to Tottenham for the second successive season and taken 3 points in a way which has driven them mad. Only, yesterday, one of their fans didn't go so crazy that they kicked our goalkeeper.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think if you watch the fallout on social media, their fans have still gone pretty crazy. So a lot to enjoy, like you say. I think the North London Derby is quite a funny game. Like, a lot of mad stuff happens in it.
Yeah.
And this definitely, I think, can be, another entry in that history, because it was a very odd 90 minutes, but one that turned out all right for Arsenal, so it's fine by me.
I think that's true of quite a lot of derby games, that there is this weird dynamic that it's almost inexplicable as to why so many crazy things happen in these fixtures. And it's happened down the years, with Arsenal, Tottenham, and made reference to this in our preview podcast on Patreon, where, even when we had the Invincibles, and man for man, they were just so superior to what Tottenham had at that time, it was always difficult to go there. There were always these crazy games. Remember that? Was it a 5-4 or 5-3 game? Pires and Ljungberg and Fabregas. 5-4, I think it was. Yeah, 5-4. And it was like, how is this happening? How can this happen with these players and those players? But that is just part of the dynamic of these derby games. So we'll get into it and discuss, how it went and what happened and the things that we enjoyed and the things we didn't quite enjoy as much, I guess. All, let's remember, with an undercurrent of laughing at Tottenham because we beat them. So that is the thing that will run through this entire podcast.
Well, I've got to say, the first half, which we'll get into shortly, was one of the funniest 45 minutes of football that I've ever seen. my sort of main takeaway from the Chelsea game in midweek, which I watched in Spain with my Chelsea-supporting brother, which was a particular delight, was that it was just a very, very funny occasion. And I think that carried through into what happened at White Hart Lane.
Yeah.
Starting, by the way, with the trumpeters atop the toilet bowl.
I mean, that was hilarious. That really, I was like, is this something they do all the time? Because I don't watch Tottenham games, but it feels to me this was a special occasion for them. So they brought in a couple of guys with trumpets.
Mm. Trumping into the toilet from
trumpeting
from its lid
from the cistern, and they were standing on the cistern looking into the toilet bowl trumpeting away. I mean, where do you go after that? What happens at the end of that game? Do you just sort of trudge disconsolately home with your I better take my trumpet and go home now? That didn't go as well as we would have liked.
Do they have to stay up there the whole game? Presumably they couldn't get down. They were stood up there next to the bird, the weather vane, or the toilet duck, as I think we should rename it.
Toilet duck. Yeah, that was weird, wasn't it? Because when that was happening, I was like, this is fucking strange, because they were doing their when the Spurs go marching in thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't very inspiring to hear a couple of reedy, trebly trumpets from fucking 200 feet in the air.
Well, you know. Evidently. So it didn't help them.
I mean, other clubs, they do like fire. Arsenal do a bit of fire. You know, get people going with fire. Tottenham have got fucking two lads with rusty trombones up the top of the fucking stadium.
So that was very funny. And as the teams lined up below, any big thoughts about the starting 11?
Not really. I was sort of expecting Jorginho to play rather than Thomas Partey, but beyond that, there wasn't anything particularly surprising. I thought there might have been a decision to make at left wing, but Trossard's form has been such that, you know, he's obviously played himself into the team, and I think Martinelli's form also has been such that even if you could make a case for him using the space that Tottenham might have left behind, I didn't really have any issue with the lineup at all. Did you?
No, the Partey-Jorginho one was the big decision for me. And I was a little bit surprised it went the way it did. I thought Partey was very good against Chelsea. But I just thought this, like you, I thought this might have been a Jorginho game. And I have to be honest and say there were times, particularly in the first half, when I sort of wished that it was. Because what was so funny to me, anyway, about that first 45 minutes is that while we found ourselves three goals up, I'm not sure we played especially well. And there were still some uncharacteristically sloppy moments in possession.
Yeah, I think so. Particularly in that first 30 minutes, you know, I think we talk about Partey, and in general, I think he was very good on the ball. But about 4 or 5 minutes in, he gets caught on the ball in midfield. They just nicked it off him from behind. I think we gave it away a few times. They had most of the possession. You know, there were moments in our box where I thought, okay, could we get rid of it? I think Trossard lost it in the box at one point as well. Mm-hmm. But then, even despite that, you could see that there was danger coming from Arsenal. It was a great pass from Partey to Havertz. He put it in the net, but he was offside. And a minute later, we're ahead with a goal from a corner, which of course is very welcome, because set pieces have been so important for us this season, and we've gone through a little bit of a fallow period with them in the last little while.
Yeah, I think even before that, the way we won the corner was kind of interesting. Arsenal were doing something a little bit different in terms of the way they set up out of possession. They had this very narrow diamond almost in midfield, and Sky at one point sort of zoomed right out on the match coverage so you could see it. You know, it was like Havertz and Odegaard as a front two, and then a diamond with Rice actually seemingly the most advanced, pressing high, trying to nick the ball off Højbjerg, whoever it might be, and Saka and Trossard tucking right in, Partey at the base. And it gave you the impression that Arsenal felt like they could catch Spurs, you know, that they had enough players who maybe weren't that secure in possession that we could get after them. And I think we did. You know, we targeted Davis, who was tucking into midfield. And I think it, one of those turnovers essentially led to that first corner. So
yeah, it was
interesting from a tactical perspective.
It was a poor kick from the goalkeeper. It was a poor pass out to Davis on the left-hand side. He just tried to hook it up the line, and we won it high up the pitch. I think Odegaard fed Rice. Rice shot out for a corner. And, well, we have the first set piece. We have the first mention of your friend and mine and everybody else's, the golden thighs of Ben White meddling with the goalkeeper. I have to say, I found this kind of astonishing, because, you know, anyone who has watched Arsenal, we talk all the time, don't we, about, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago, actually, about why have the set piece goals dried up? Is it a case that the opposition analysts are looking at Arsenal and they've kind of figured out what we're doing? So is it incumbent on us to come up with some new routines? And we talk all the time about how nothing lasts really in the Premier League, like a tactical shift or the way a team sets up can be really effective for a period of time. But then there are so many people analyzing games and analyzing the strengths of the opposition. What do they do here? When they're positioned here, what way are they going to move? All of that stuff, like in minute detail. And yet Tottenham have allowed Ben White, who has like caused mayhem and annoyed goalkeepers all season long. This is what he does. He just gets in there, fiddles with the goalkeeper's glove as he did yesterday, which was really, really funny. Vicario's just kind of swatting
him
away.
Just trying to help him, just making sure his gloves are on properly.
Yeah, exactly. He's a very conscientious young man, Ben White. But
a good Samaritan of the six-yard box.
But, you know, that did play a small part in maybe unsettling the goalkeeper. And, you know, I'm not sure about the defence. They were all standing there. The Arsenal players ran across the box. Tomiyasu put some pressure on Højbjerg. Højbjerg heads it into his own net. It's 1-0 Arsenal. And this continued, and we'll talk about the third goal, obviously. But at no point in that first half did any Tottenham player or anyone from the Tottenham bench do anything about what Ben White was doing from set pieces. In the second half, they obviously had a conversation at halftime and said, well, we've got to stop him doing this. But the fact that they weren't even aware of it going into the game is kind of remarkable to me.
Yeah. I mean, Nicholas Jovers received his flowers today from the Arsenal fans and the wider media, and rightly so. But I think, what's the opposite of flowers? Some shit in an envelope?
Yeah, weeds, I guess.
I think those things need to be delivered to Spurs as well, because I think they're as bad at set pieces as we are good. You know, this has been a big theme for them across the season. And as you say, the lack of preparation for what Arsenal are going to do. Gary Neville said it on commentary. It's kind of the same setup from Arsenal as it's been all through 2024. You know, running the big train from the back post, all those guys lining up and that making that late dash. They just seem completely unprepared for it. And I thought Ben White delivered a masterclass, I have to say, in terms of how he sort of distracted the goalkeeper. And on this first goal, for example, his movement is actually really good. So he's standing in an offside, not offside when the corner's taken, but he's standing right on the goal line with the goalkeeper. What he does so smartly is by the time the near post flick on happens, he's got himself back onside so that if it then comes across goal, he's actually in a position to put it into the net. It's not like he's just stood there and messing about. He's got a clear plan and he executes it brilliantly.
Yeah.
This was the corner that Saka was trying in the 93rd minute in Munich, right? Sometimes you don't need
maybe.
To. Man. Sometimes they do the job for you.
Maybe so. I mean, there will be focus, and obviously so, on Ben White's shithousery and the stuff he gets up to. Can I just say as well, I think he put in a really good defensive performance yesterday.
Yeah.
He was fantastic in his primary role as right back, and then this stuff on top of it. Postecoglou afterwards, he said, I thought if fixing defensive set pieces was the answer to us bridging the gap, I'd put all my time and effort into that, he said, which was rather dismissive considering his team conceded two goals from set pieces. And, you know, had they put a bit more effort and a bit more preparation into dealing with set pieces beforehand, they might have had a different result in this game. So I found his like post-game comments really weird as well.
Well, you know what? Arsenal fans won't thank me for this, but I have to say, watching Spurs, particularly in that first half, they reminded me of us a few years ago. You know, they play some good stuff, they make chances, but they're let down by a lack of structure, defensive sloppiness, individual errors. And I don't think they have a coach right now who is particularly minded to address that. So long may it continue.
Yeah, long may it continue. So after that goal, Tottenham had some moments, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
There was a Romero header which went just wide, although I think had that gone in, it would probably have been ruled out for what looked like an obvious foul on Martin Odegaard. Romero pushes him in the face in order to get to the ball, and I'm not sure that would have stood. Nevertheless, it was a dangerous moment, and Romero again got above Thomas Partey to head against the post from a corner.
Yeah, that was a good delivery, that one.
Yeah.
And, we were caught under it a bit. This was all in the space of 5 minutes. And then they had the ball in the net as well.
They did. It was offside, as it turns out. But again, very close. It's like half a step from Gabriel. Could have been the difference between that being 1-1 and, you know, subsequently, you know, what happened in that first half where we got ourselves into a commanding lead. So there are, you know, fine margins in these games, aren't there, where things go your way. You do get the rub of the green very slightly. And I watched your video. I thought it was really interesting about, you know, how outcome really has an impact on what people think about or what they say about what's going on the pitch. And ultimately, the fine margins can dictate quite a lot in how people view the result, the performance, the capability of the team and all the rest.
Yeah, I found it fascinating watching the TV coverage. And I know that TV coverage has a sort of tendency to narrativize and spin story out of outcome. But at halftime, you know, Arsenal were 3-0 up and to my mind were quite lucky to be in that position. And yet all the punditry, all the analysis was, this is Arsenal now. Look how mature they are. Mm. You know, they know how to win when playing badly. I'm not saying there's no truth in this, but it was very kind of reductive. And then when a couple of goals would go in the other end, you know, you start hearing the same things of, oh, this is the Arsenal of last year. You know, the familiar weaknesses coming to the surface. And of course, like, neither is really true. What's really happening is there are these quite sort of chaotic moments that, as you say, are being defined by millimetres in either direction. And these huge sweeping conclusions being drawn from them, sometimes in the space of the same 90 minutes.
Yeah.
It is quite absurd. But I do think we rode our luck a little bit in that first half. I mean, you know, that offside goal, when who was it? When Coventry City had the ball in the net against Man United in the final minute of extra time, I was saying, well, you know, is that the spirit of the law? Is any real advantage gained there? That is actually what I think. So, you know, I do see that you've got to try kind of apply that across the board. But under the current rules, with the lines at where they are, he is off. Have you seen what Spurs fans are complaining about this morning? They're unhappy that I think they feel that the shot deflects and when Tomiyasu plays the ball, it should reset the offside.
But it didn't, you know? That rule change though? Am I wrong in thinking that that rule has been changed?
I think so, because basically his playing of the ball is not deemed, even though it's a block, is not sort of deemed a deliberate action.
Yeah. Didn't we have a similar one?
Yeah, we definitely did, because we had this debate ourselves.
It could have been an Eddie Nketiah goal, or the ball hit Eddie Nketiah and somebody went on and scored and then it was ruled out because I can't remember. And we're all sort of going, well, you know, it was a deflection and it wasn't a deliberate. I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I remember something like this.
Well, the point being, whatever the truth of the situation, it was extremely funny. I don't think we should lose sight of this. You know, they got the goal, they had the big celebrations, mm-hmm. The crowd were up, and then it was taken away from them. Beautiful. And then, 2 minutes later, we went up the other end of the pitch and scored. Oh, and that came moments after they felt they should have had two penalties.
Yeah, well, you know, what they feel and what's real are two very different things. Neither of those are penalties, in my opinion.
No. I actually think, I've seen a lot of people say the Kulusevski one maybe is more neutrals. I don't think so. I think there's an angle which is kind of behind Kulusevski and Trossard, which makes it look like a trip. But there's another angle where it looks like he just kicks his own heel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it may well be that there was a slight touch from Trossard. I don't know, but nothing was definitive. And even if it was, I don't think he can give a penalty. I don't think you should.
I certainly don't think you can overturn an on-field decision.
No, and also, wasn't it interesting that I wrote about this during the week, where I was speculating that there had been some new edict about raising the threshold for physical contact in the box for a penalty, and then they were talking about that as if, like, we all knew that, as if there'd been some kind of announcement on that. So
we didn't get the memo, I guess.
No, nobody did. And then it's part of the commentary, which is kind of how PGMOL tend to communicate things rather than via, you know, an actual communication. Do you remember at the start of the season in the Charity Shield or Community Shield, we had the commentators telling us that these new rules about kicking the ball away and, you know, delaying a quick free kick, that's going to be a yellow card now. And everyone's like, oh, Well, yeah, that's something new. Would have been
they're
nice.
They're just soft launching their new ideas via Gary Neville.
Yeah, God almighty. Anyway.
I didn't think either were a pen.
No.
And then what followed was obviously brilliant from an Arsenal perspective. Shades of 2004, sweeping counter-attack end-to-end. I do have to take a little bit of time to talk about what on earth Spurs were doing in those moments, particularly Ben Davies, who... I mean, it was apocalyptically bad defending, I think.
I think it was. And I just want to, before we get on to that goal and the move, because I think there's a lot to like about it, it would be remiss of us on a day like today not to call out James Maddison for what was an obvious dive that thankfully the ref didn't buy for a single second. And he is really just a terrible, cheating little prick. And I think it's important for us to get that across. There was a moment in the first half as well where I think they had a corner and he went down clutching his face in the box. He was doing that grappling thing with Tomiyasu. They showed a replay. Yeah. They showed a replay. There was nothing. Nothing at all. And he's gone down holding his face. But somehow cheeky Mads, you know, who's the fucking head boy at the Maddison family Sunday roasts, he decides who gets the fucking Yorkshire puddings, which is about all he's good for, really. Anyway, I just wanted to call out that dive because it was a dive. Rice wins the ball. He goes over theatrically and we go up and score. So fuck
James
Maddison.
He looked like he'd been hit by one of his own imaginary darts.
Yeah.
So that was great. And the goal itself, obviously it's well worked and it's a brilliant pass from Kai Havertz. I do think there was a moment where I thought it had gone, you know, because he held the ball slightly longer than I certainly on my sofa wanted. But he did play the right pass in the end. And where the Spurs defenders are all going and where they think Bukayo Saka is at that particular moment in time, I do not know.
Mm.
And obviously it's a brilliant pass from a guy who had a really good game and Saka is really composed, but I don't even think it's Saka's best turn inside. I'm not sure he gets his feet quite right and yet he's still able to do the thing every single person watching knows he's going to do.
Yes. I mean, I think maybe the slight... I don't want to say clumsiness, but the touch inside the box is not his cleanest, right?
No.
But that is completely offset by his first touch from the Havertz pass, which reminds me, ever see that video of Ronaldinho where he's just sort of booting the ball up in the air? It's like a warm-up and he's having a grand old time just kind of wandering around the pitch and he boots the ball about 3,000 feet in the air, takes a few steps, waits for it to come down and just sort of kills it dead on his foot. It reminded me of that. It's so good, that first touch. But then you're right. You know, what Ben Davies does and what Ben Davies should do are you know, two completely different things. It's easy to say, you know, show him onto his right foot, but that's what you should do there if you're a good defender, is try and show Bukayo Saka onto his right foot. I mean, he can still finish with his right foot. But, you know, he comes back inside. The touch is not brilliant, but still the defending's not good enough and he rolls it home to make it 2-0. I think it's a great goal.
It's a brilliant goal. And as I say, coming off the back of a period of Spurs pressure. So it was just a wonderful moment to see us go up the other end and score and find ourselves 2-0 up. I mean, it was exactly what we needed at that moment in the game. And I think we actually have to say... you know, give Arsenal a bit of credit here as well. Like I say, I don't think this was a great performance, particularly in that first 45 minutes. Ironically, I think we played better in the second half and lost that 2-0. But when we countered on them, we did so with real purpose and threat.
Yes.
You know, there was a moment early on where Kai Havertz had the ball in the net and was offside. But when we went forward... we carried real menace, and this was a brilliant execution of a counter.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there was actually talk about this on the TV about how Arsenal were decisive going forward, and I think that's right. We were quicker with our passing. We were quicker with our movement. We knew, you know, when those spaces opened up, how we were going to get into them. And the talk on TV was like, well, you know, the moments where Spurs turned over the ball and they didn't go at Arsenal, they didn't attack Arsenal, which is probably fair, but I also think it's important to point out that the defensive discipline and organisation in this Arsenal team, despite the fact we conceded a couple of really scrappy goals in the second half, in general, is really, really impressive. So by the time Spurs' tiny little brain switched on to the idea that they might have had an opportunity to get at us, we had men behind the ball, or we were blocking those passing lanes. So I think they didn't do quite as much as they could have, but I think the Arsenal defenders, and you know the wide players in particular, Bukayo Saka has a goal. He has an assist as well. Does forcing an own goal from a corner count as an assist? I'm not 100% sure.
I feel like it should do.
But look at Bukayo Saka's defensive contribution. Five tackles, two interceptions, one clearance. Kai Havertz, four clearances. You know, Declan Rice with five tackles. Martin Odegaard, three tackles. You know, the players that we have in those forward areas are so quick to get back that it makes it so difficult for the opposition to try and hurt you when you do lose the ball in the slightly scrappy way that we lost it at times in yesterday's game.
Yeah, that's true. We collapsed brilliantly into our defensive shape. And when Spurs were on the ball in their own half, you know, we set up brilliantly to press them and counter them in that respect. So, yeah, it was a good defensive performance. One ultimately, and we'll get onto it, let down by, you know, just moments of sloppiness. But before that, we had a third goal.
This is a very funny goal as well. You know, not only was Ben White at it again with nobody anywhere near him. I mean, I don't know. What's the keeper doing there, by the way? I mean,
we can talk about... he's a disaster on corners, this guy. Yeah. It's been happening all season long. White gives him a little bump, doesn't he? Just as the ball comes in. And it's very weak goalkeeping, I have to say, on both the corner goals.
But why isn't he? Like, we can talk about what Tottenham's manager and coaches didn't see and didn't react to until the second half. But why is Vicario, having been on the receiving end, you know, more than once by that stage, how is he not talking to one of his defenders to tell them, you get between... I mean, it's dumb as fuck from the Tottenham defenders, by the way, because, like, at the very low level I played in my life, if the opposition player tried to do that to our goalkeeper, you would one of the defenders would stand between that player and the goalkeeper to protect the goalkeeper and allow him to move in a way that you need your goalkeeper to move. You would do it at Sunday League level, you know? It's crazy to me that A, none of the Tottenham defenders reacted, and B, the goalkeeper didn't tell them, hey, fucking one of you guys, give me a hand here, right? So
do you know what? I think sometimes you leave your keeper to it because you know your keeper has so many advantages over the outfielder. You know, usually he's taller, he's stronger, he's able to come and use his hands, and the referee gives him the benefit of the doubt in 80% of situations like that.
Yeah, at least.
So, yeah. You know, with a lot of keepers, you'd say, all right, yeah, you've got a fullback stood near you who's a bit of a nuisance, but that's your job to win that battle. And I just don't think Vicario does that at all. It's a good, really good delivery from Declan Rice. And Kai Havertz heads it home. I have to say, he was so relaxed about his celebration that I initially thought it'd been another own goal.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it, though, the movement is brilliant because he runs off, I think it's Kulusevski. He runs off Kulusevski, who runs into a crowd of his own players. I mean, Jesus, these Tottenham players are dumb. And Havertz gets around, gets up, nods it home. Vicario's nowhere because he's been, you know, bumped all over the place by Ben White. He doesn't know what day of the week it is. And it's a lovely goal. It's a lovely finish from Havertz, lovely header, who I thought actually yesterday was really, really good. I think the two players I would pick out from an Arsenal perspective yesterday were Bukayo Saka and Kai Havertz. And I thought Havertz' all-round play, the way he runs, the way he works for the team, the outlet he gave us, the way he won the aerial duels, the way he held it up at times. There was one time in particular where we were struggling to get it out, and he held the ball up and won us a free kick just to ease the pressure. I thought it was just a really, really impressive center forwards display from Havertz, you know, on top of a goal and assist as well.
Yeah, I thought he was our best player on the day. The numbers in terms of his attacking contribution continue to be really impressive. Is it something like 9 in 11 or something crazy like that? I don't know. Mm. He's on a brilliant run of form. A run of form that, you know, if we went and spent big on a striker in the summer, as there's been some discussion about, if they produce anything like these kinds of numbers, you know, I think we'd be very content with that. Mm. The other thing I would say about him is he's played so many minutes, and I think he's maybe the only player in the squad who I don't think has ever looked particularly tired. You know, his fitness levels must be amazing because he just keeps going. And for a manager, you know, that's such a gift. I suppose in some ways, you know, that's the way in which he's most reminiscent of Granit Xhaka. I know, you know, ostensibly he was bought to replace him, but he's now playing a very different position, a very different role. But they share that capacity to seemingly always be available and these huge reserves of stamina that they, you know, show off in 90 minutes. I mean, the ground he covers is quite amazing.
And I think that's probably part of what makes him a favourite of Mikel Arteta's as well, is that that energy, you know, there isn't really a drop in, you know, his physical output. You know, you can, players, their form and what they produce fluctuates over the course of the season. But I do think the one consistent thing to Kai Havertz since he arrived, and I think we'll all acknowledge it took him a while to settle in properly and show the best form that we've seen in the last little while. But it was never a case that he didn't shirk his job or his running or his defensive duties. You know, that was there from the start. And I think that's part of what makes Mikel Arteta so fond of him. Before we move off this goal and onto the second half, we do have to talk about what was very funny about it was the three guys behind Declan Rice as he's about to take that corner. The three unfortunate looking men behind Declan Rice, who, as many point out, one of them looked like Weird Al Yankovic.
Yes.
But they're giving him dog's abuse as he's taking that corner. And if you watch again, what's hilarious about this is not just the fact that when Kai Havertz heads in, Declan Rice turns around and gives them a bit back. It's the fact that Weird Al just goes storming off up the stairs. I don't know if he's going for a piss or a shit or a pint or whatever, but he just can't take it anymore. And having made an absolute dickhead of himself on live television and, you know, all around the world, not just the millions of people that were watching on Sky, that was on the Premier League feed everywhere in the world. You're jumping up and down like a moron, and Declan Rice and Kai Havertz and Arsenal just made you look like a twat. It's so funny.
I know. So great. And even the first goal, there's a video I've seen from the Spurs end. I mean, why anyone would film this as a Spurs fan and then release it into the world, I do not know. But it's of them giving dog's abuse to Bukayo Saka, singing, you know, you let your country down, just before he takes that corner and Højbjerg heads into his own net. Thoroughly enjoyed that. And Saka, even after his goal, gave it the old hands to the ears.
He did. You can find that video on Arsblog today in the Arsblog post. It's from, I think, Fun with Flares on Twitter. And like you, I'm amazed that a Tottenham fan would film that and then upload it. But I guess it's sort of part of the world we live in right now. You know, these fail compilation videos where somebody's doing something in their bedroom and they're the only ones filming and something goes terribly wrong. Like I don't know. And then they still upload it to the internet. I don't know what's wrong with people.
I know. Absolutely mad. But, you know, very, very funny.
Very funny for us. And I enjoyed it a great deal. So second half. Fair to say, I think that Arsenal could have been further ahead. There was a Tomiyasu diving header. There was a chance for Saka, whether he would have been offside or not. I'm not sure it was a Havertz
cross.
Some
people have said that was offside, but I've watched the replay and I'm not convinced it was. If you look at who knows with VAR and where those lines would be drawn. I actually felt that was quite a big moment, that, because I think if you score early in the second half, I know it sounds absurd when you're already 3-0 up, but at that point, it's completely over, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas I think I suppose we've got to give the keeper, having given him his shit in an envelope, give him one flower. Yeah. That was a decent save. But yeah, I suppose it just kept the match alive. But I will say that we started the second half in general much better than we did the first. Mm. And, you know, Tomiyasu had that chance, didn't he, from a set piece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that by, funnily enough, around kind of the hour mark, I was thinking, oh, we actually look very comfortable here. Mm. And I was even thinking we might score more goals. You know,
yeah, me too.
Looking at a really historic victory.
Me too. I'm just looking at the replay again of the Saka chance. I'm with you. I don't think he's going to be. Don't think he's going to be offside there.
No, I know that there's an angle from the side where he looks offside, but if you follow kind of the grass, the lines on the pitch, I think Havertz is okay.
Yeah, but there's a guy in the middle. Is it Davies or, I don't know, it could be Højbjerg. Not 100% sure, but it looks like Højbjerg could be playing him onside.
But I won't claim to be able to second guess VAR. So who knows? But it was a great chance. I'm sorry to say, a brilliant save.
But. Yes, it was a great save. But it was sort of playing out to, you know, what looked like it was going to be a routine Arsenal win.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a very big mistake from David Raya, which just sort of gave them a goal. It gave them hope. I don't like that. I don't like giving them anything. Not even the one flower. I wouldn't, you know, even a dandelion. I wouldn't give them the dandelion as a flower. But yeah, it's a big mistake. How do you view this? Arteta said, where was it? What was he going to say? I didn't like the principles we applied at that moment. And after that, a mistake can happen. You misjudge the situation. You try to make the pass and you don't. And then you have doubts. So I think there's two things we need to discuss. One is obviously the mistake from Raya. And the other is Raya's response to the mistake.
Yeah, because I think he responded really, really well. I think, because what happens is Romero, who by this point was in full Romero mode. You know, I think moments earlier he'd sort of ploughed into Tomiyasu, who didn't make much of a fuss about it.
Mm.
And I thought, here we go. You know, the red card is probably imminent. And what happens in this instance is he just charges up the field from his own penalty area to basically playing up front. And I think maybe Arsenal are guilty. I don't know if that's the word, but maybe looking to sort of bypass him. You know, I think that Declan Rice, for example, sees Romero run past him and thinks, well, rather than go with him, I'm going to wait in the gap that he's left. And if David Raya can find a pass beyond him or over him as he tries, that's, I think it's five or six Spurs players out the game.
Mm.
Now, I don't know what Mikel Arteta exactly means when he says he doesn't like the principles. Does he think that was a sort of an unnecessarily ambitious thing to do,
yes,
a 3-0 up? Does he think that the players around Raya hadn't given him enough easy options?
I'm looking at it again. I've watched this quite a few times. I don't think that pass is on. I just don't think that pass is on. It's a difficult pass with your
good foot.
And it's
his left foot as well.
And it's his left foot.
He's a great passer, but much more so with his right than his left.
Yeah. I had a little bit of a discussion with somebody on the Arsis today about this as well, where perhaps when Arteta's talking about the principles of it, you know, Thomas Partey is looking and showing for the ball, but he's asking him to make a pass that really isn't on. And I'm not blaming Partey. It's 100% a mistake from David Raya. But I do wonder if in that situation, I know this is a split-second thing, Partey needs to just sort of say, look, put it back upfield. Spurs have committed men forward. We do have a player up there in Kai Havertz who has won a lot of aerial duels. So if you get it in his direction, it's quite possible we could win the header, win the flick on, and get somebody in behind. Who knows? I think it's a bad mistake from Raya, obviously. But I do think as well, it's one of those where, you know, if that situation develops again in a game, and I know they only have a split second to make a decision and think about what they're going to do, the thing to do in that case is just put your foot through the ball, because it's not the best pass back to him from Saliba. It's not like a bad pass, but it's not the best pass. And I just think that cocktail of, even if the ball does go to Partey, there are quite, what, two or three Spurs players around him as well. So I like the way we play, generally speaking. I like that we're capable of playing around the press, and we want to keep the ball, but there are moments in a game where you're away from home, it's a North London derby, just don't give them anything stupid, don't give them any kind of encouragement or hope. And unfortunately, that's kind of what we did in that moment.
I think it's a really interesting kind of case study about sort of the duality of Partey, because I don't think Raya would give Jorginho the ball in that position.
I 100% agree, and I don't think Jorginho would be looking for the ball in that situation either. So I think it is there is something to that. Yeah.
But the brilliance of Partey when he's playing well and when things go right for him is that you can give him the ball in that situation and he can wriggle out of it. The other side of that coin, as we saw, I think, in the first 5 minutes of the game, is that sometimes he'll try things that he gets caught on.
Mm.
I just think that sort of illustrates, I think, that what he comes with. He gives you that verticality and that ability to kind of find a way through the press, and he's got astonishing talent in that regard. But he does carry that riskiness with him.
Mm.
All that said, obviously it's on Raya, but I do also maintain that if you ask your keepers to be as involved as he is in our build-up, then two or three times per season, this is going to happen.
Mm.
And it happens to every team who plays this way, even the very best in the world, the Edisons and the Allisons. This does happen to them. So I'm never, ever going to kill a keeper for being caught out with a misplaced pass when outfield players misplace passes, you know, multiple times per game.
Like, I have to say, I really liked the response from Raya, because it could be a case that you get jittery and you get nervous and you second guess yourself, or you decide, right, I'm not going to put myself in a position where I'm going to make a mistake again. I think his kicking changed a little bit after that mistake. I think we were more inclined to go long, obviously. But where I thought he was really impressive was with crosses. His handling was solid. It was decisive. You know, he came for things. He got the things. Like, if he'd come for one of those and missed one of those, like, the last 20 minutes would have been absolute chaos, because they'd have just been pumping balls at him. But he was really, really impressive in that regard. I enjoyed the reaction at the final whistle, where he and his teammates celebrated. He knew he'd kind of gotten away with one a little bit. I like the fact that when a player makes a mistake in this Arsenal team, we no longer have this culture where someone makes a mistake and they don't own it, and they point at somebody else, or they blame somebody else, and don't need to go through that in any great detail, because you all understand what I'm saying. We've seen it too many times where these mistakes happen. Everyone trudges back, heads go down, and the guy who makes the mistake is blaming the goalkeeper or blaming somebody else. We don't have that anymore, and I think that's really important to point out. The reaction at the end was good. Raya's reaction to the mistake was really good. But there's still a part of me that is slightly begrudges him the trauma he put me through for the last few minutes of this game.
Because without that moment.
Yeah, without that, it's a routine.
You know, I think it's probably fine. And maybe there's even a fourth and a fifth. And, you know, I mentioned the sweeping counter-attack goal reminded me of 2004. In some respects, the game did. You know, that was a game where Arsenal were playing there to win the title. We're in a commanding 2-0 position, and Spurs came back into it, got two goals of their own, and a keeper was kind of at the heart of that in some respects, in Jens Lehmann. Fortunately, this time we had the third goal, which gave us that added bit of protection. Because I just think in a derby, particularly this derby, which is always so helter-skelter, you're never 100% safe.
No, 100%. 100%, we're not 100% safe. I agree. Because, like, a thing can happen in an instant where all of a sudden the complexion changes, and that's what happened in the 84th minute, 85th minute, Declan Rice. This was interesting again for Arteta for the penalty. It was another principle inside the box that you cannot do, which is let the ball bounce. You can't let the ball come down.
I thought you were going to say, which is kick someone right in the balls.
To be fair, I think it was more underside of the thigh, but you know.
So he missed. Shame.
He missed. He missed all the balls. He missed all three balls.
You're right. You're right to make that point. I mean, it was scrappy stuff, and unlike us in some respect.
So they have a penalty, and it's 3-2, and Son scores, and there's still, whatever, 5 minutes of normal time and six
I was looking
minutes.
For the concourse of my flat at that point in time. The corridor rather than the concourse.
Yeah, there would truly have been a corridor of uncertainty, wouldn't it? Because
a lot of people messaged me actually saying, like, I now understand that feeling you've had of, like, I can barely watch this. I know of quite a few people who had to leave the room.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
I've seen it in, you know, on Twitter replies, and I've seen it in our Discord as well. People who just, you know, went, no, I can't do this. I'm going to go sit in the garden. I'm going to go walk the dog. I'm going to turn the TV off. Like, there was one reply I saw. Sorry, I can't remember who it was, but someone, he saw how much normal time was remaining, added on the extra time that he thought was going to, like, 12 minutes thereabouts, set a timer, turned it off, and came back to find out what had happened. Like, I have to say, I've spoken to people, you know, who were like, oh, I came very close to turning this game off. And, you know, I completely and utterly understand that, because those last, whatever it was, 10 minutes or so after the second goal were genuinely, genuinely horrible, because everyone could envisage 100,000 ways that Spurs might get that equalizing goal. And it was a question of holding on, digging in. You know, for the most part, I think we did well. They might have had one shot, but when they have corners, when they have a free kick deep in our half, when they're sending their goalkeeper up for a corner as well, you're like, oh, no. Please just don't do this. Even Arteta said he was praying on the sideline.
Well, because I think we've all enjoyed this immensely, and it's always great to win a derby. But we have to just take a brief moment to acknowledge that had they somehow come up with a third goal, I think it would have been the worst thing ever.
Yes.
I honestly cannot think of a worse thing that could have happened. Because not only would it have been all the narrative about bottling it and, you know, same as last season, Liverpool, West Ham.
Mm.
But Spurs would have been able to claim that they derailed our title challenge, justifiably claim they derailed our title challenge. It would have been Spurs. They would have been happy. I honestly, like, I know we've had some traumas as Arsenal fans down the years. Newcastle away and big defeats at Liverpool and Chelsea and United. I think this would have been the worst thing ever.
I think it would really have undermined what we've done this season, which is a weird thing to say, because we've had this conversation about outcome and how the narrative is shaped by results. But I think it would have. It would have just been the case. Arsenal are 3-0 up, coasting away from home in the North London derby, and somehow they contrive to throw the game away and drop a couple of points and basically hand the title hook, line and sinker to Manchester City. I mean,
it makes me feel sick even hearing you
say that. I know,
that.
Yeah, I know. I've got, like, that feeling in my stomach again, that almost as if I'm reliving those last 10 minutes by talking about them to you. So it was hugely important, wasn't it, that Arsenal were able to get this over the line. And, you know, maybe there is a difference between this Arsenal and you know, Arsenals of the not-too-distant past, where perhaps we wouldn't have been able to. Perhaps the frailty that is inherent in the team, which I think was evident in certain performances and certain results, you know, we've, I'm not going to say got rid of it completely, but maybe there is just enough inner strength there, enough character, quality, resilience, whatever you want to call it, to see off, you know, an energized Tottenham in the last 10 minutes of this, because it was our own fault and we had to correct that and we had to make sure that we got this result in 3 points.
Yeah, and I suppose you would say, in fairness, that if there was an Arsenal team in recent years that you would trust could see out those final few moments, it would be this team. But yeah, it was still absolutely terrifying. And again, another sort of echo 2004 in some respects. Let's hope it's a positive omen. But I liked the way that despite the second half not really going in their favour, the players still absolutely claimed it and planted a sort of metaphorical flag in the ground at full time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes,
celebrated
for sure.
Properly.
We've talked about this before, but I think there is often a difference between how a game feels when you're watching versus how a game feels when you're playing.
Yeah.
Like at the end of that game, the only thing that the Arsenal players gave a single shit about was the fact that they'd won the game and yeah. taken 3 points.
And that's all
points.
They cared about before.
Sure.
You know, that's all that mattered on this occasion.
Yeah. Whereas we're sitting here going, well, they could have done that better. They could have done this way. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do this. You know, of course they're going to analyze the game and they're going to learn from it and everything else. But in that moment, you know, we're sitting there absolutely relieved. I'm sure there was a measure of relief from them as well. But ultimately it was about, well, we've gone to White Hart Lane. We've won the derby. We've taken 3 points. We've put a little bit of pressure temporarily on Manchester City. And, you know, we did what we needed to do. All the discussions before this game would have been about whatever happens, however it happens, take 3 points. And that's what we did. So,
and I think we should contextualize that as well. I think, is it just the second time? No, let me get this right. We've won consecutive games at White Hart Lane. Is it for the first time in 35 years?
Yeah, it was George Graham was manager the last time we did that.
I mean, that shows you how difficult that is to do. And also, let's look at the week.
Yes.
We've had. Since going out of the Champions League, the response has been amazing. And, you know, obviously the winning at Wolves was great. But then to beat Chelsea and Spurs, putting 8 goals past them, it's, you know, you don't get many better weeks as an Arsenal fan.
No, on their own merits, those two games are really, really impressive. And it takes a lot to do that. Like, I think these two games were so pivotal to what might still happen in this season. I said this to you last week. I think if we win these two games, we've got a great chance because we've got other winnable fixtures. And I do wonder if there might be a slip along the way for Manchester City. Maybe there won't be. But, you know, you looked at these two fixtures on paper and thought, that's going to be tough. That is going to be really tough for all the reasons that we all understand about derby games and what's at stake and, you know.
Spurs was the one for me, I have to say. I take nothing for granted in the remaining games because we've, you know, seen how we can drop points unexpectedly. But Spurs was the one that I always thought, well, that's going to be really difficult.
Yeah, it was our most, this was the most difficult fixture, for sure. Yeah. For sure.
So fantastic to have come through it. Mm-hmm. And after losing to Villa, you know, I think we both kind of felt, well, to give ourselves a shot, we're probably going to have to win all our games. We are doing that currently. So, and look at what's happening at Liverpool. Sustaining this kind of form at this stage of the season is not straightforward.
No. A big, big win. Big win. And I think one that the team will take a lot from. And they've got a week off now, more or less, to sort of rest and recuperate and to you know, get some freshness back in the legs ahead of an early kickoff against Bournemouth on Saturday. So all in all, I think you'd have to say it was a great day. It's a great day.
It was very much a great day.
Okay, let's take a little break here. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
I look at her, she stares almost straight back at me. But her eyes glaze over like she's looking straight through me. Then her eyes must have closed for what seems an eternity. When they open up, she's looking down at her feet.
It's just who we are, mate.
I know it's hard to take, but her mind has been made up.
It's just who we are.
There's plenty more fish in the sea.
It's just who we are, mate.
I know you want to make her see how much this pain hurts.
It's who we're gonna be.
But you've got to walk away now.
As long as I'm here.
Over.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer the questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arseblog. Also on the Arseblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arseblog member on Patreon. Just a quick shout out to our friends at the Arsenal Vision podcast. We've been supporting their fundraiser, helping to raise funds for the Arsenal Foundation in the month of April. The grand total raised this time around was £313,331, which is absolutely amazing. So thank you so much to everybody who contributed to that fundraiser. It's just incredible, the kindness and generosity of the Arsenal community, James.
Man, it's crazy. I mean, that's such a huge amount of money, and it's going to a really good cause. And yeah, congratulations to the guys, and thanks to everyone who contributed to it.
All right. We're going to do your questions. So do you want to go first?
Yeah, go on then. Yeah. We talked to him about him a little bit, but we had quite a lot of questions about Thomas Partey and his role and potentially his future. So David Johnson on Twitter said, I think we've all collectively forgotten how good Partey was in the first half of last season. Is there a question now that if we only get 20 games out of him next season, is it worth more to us than getting £20 million from Saudi? And then, you know, Aaron 1991 said, goodly morning, gents. David Ornstein expects only one of Partey and Jorginho to stay beyond the summer. We saw that Partey's ball progression is something only he offers in the squad on that level, but Jorginho is more reliable. Who would you like from them to stay?
I think it'd be really risky to go into next season depending in any way on Thomas Partey and his fitness, because I think he's been unreliable. I don't think there's ever been any question about Partey's ability as a footballer. It's been about his availability as a footballer. I guess it will come down to whether or not the club feel like the injury problems are a thing of the past or if they might be recurring. You know, we're at the end of April and he's, you know, making his first real appearances of the season. I know he had those few games at right back at the start of the season, but his first few games in midfield are at the end of April. I mean, what happens if next season something happens again and we're in the same situation where we are a player short in midfield because we've put some eggs in the Partey basket? So if you'd asked me this a few months ago, I would have said Jorginho. I don't think I will change my mind on that. I do think there is a difference in the two players, obviously. But it's just, for me, a question of, you know, are you going to learn your lesson about this guy's fitness? Yeah, and that's what would make me wary.
We've fallen into this trap many times before, haven't we? Where, you know, we see shiny Thomas Partey doing shiny Thomas Partey things and we think, imagine if we had him every game, and it doesn't happen. For me, I think there is actually another point beyond the fitness as well. As I kind of alluded to it in part one, I think there is this duality to his game where he does bring you all this progressive play, but there is this element of risk to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken about Zinchenko almost feeling like a relic of last season's team in some respects. And I almost feel the same way about Thomas Partey, that he's a kind of maverick talent, but one who maybe doesn't fit into the kind of super structured shape of this new Arsenal team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I could see Arteta going for someone in that position, whether it's Declan Rice or whether it's a new signing, who he feels can provide more stability and consistency. And I mean that both in terms of availability, but maybe also in terms of playing style.
Yeah, I agree. When I thought about what kind of midfielder we might buy this summer, it always felt to me like it would be a version of Jorginho more than a version of Partey, if that makes mm-hmm. sense.
I agree with that, yeah.
So whether that informs whatever happens with Partey in the summer, we'll have to wait and see. So
over to you.
Matt Taylor, who's on Twitter at AFCMatt09, he says, "Goodly St. Totteringham's morning, gents. How important do you think it's been to the squad to see Arteta behave more calmly on the touchline? Understated celebrations yesterday from the boss, and it seems to be instilling a new calmness to the team, which is key."
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know how directly it sort of correlates between Mikel's demeanour and the players' demeanour, but I really liked the way we celebrated those first two goals, you know, straight into the huddle. I think in one it was Odegaard talking, in the other it was Rice. All about focus, all about, you know, not getting lost in the emotion of the moment. So I think that was actually really encouraging. And I'm sure that the way in which Mikel behaves must inform the player's approach, right? You know, he's the last thing they hear before they go out there. They're trying to pay attention to him during the 90 minutes. How possible that actually is, who knows? But I think it speaks to a growing maturity around the project. You know, I think the same thing applies to the coach as to the players.
Mm. I think part of it as well is the fact that they said on TV yesterday that Mikel Arteta is a booking away from another touchline ban. So I think that might also be playing a part in the behavior on the sideline, because there was a moment, I don't know if you spotted this, but there was a moment in this, I can't remember if it was first half or second half, I think first half, where Ben Davies went in on Saka around the halfway line. And to me, it looked a foul, but Ben Davies was allowed to get away with quite a lot on Bukayo Saka yesterday. And you can just see Arteta almost begin to throw his hands in the air, and then he just puts both hands over his mouth to sort of stop himself saying something. So I think he's probably aware that if he is too demonstrative on the sideline, if he objects too strenuously to, you know, a sort of 50-50 decision, if you want to call it that, even if I think it was a foul on Saka, that he runs the risk of being suspended and facing a touchline ban for, you know, what could be three of the most important Arsenal games in our recent history. You know, imagine what it would be like for him to have to sit on the sideline or be in the stands, for example, if we go to Old Trafford. So I think that might just be playing a part in how he's behaving.
Well, imagine as well, if we go to Old Trafford and he picks up a booking there, and there's a game where Arsenal are playing at home against Everton, his former club, potentially to win a first Premier League title for 20 years, and he's not on the touchline.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think we can expect to see Mikel on his best behaviour over the next couple of weeks.
have another follow-up one on that. Do you mind me asking you this
one?
Yeah,
no, not at all.
From Wise Marklar on the Discord, he said, I remember Mikel Arteta being part of an Arsenal team that ground out results towards the end of the season. I think it was 13-14. It wasn't. It was 2012-13. There was a game against Queen's Park Rangers and Spurs that I remember. We lost a North London derby, and I think Arsene Wenger made a change at the back. He dropped Thomas Vermaelen, but there was some difficult games for Arsenal in that period where there was a 1-0 win away at Queen's Park Rangers. Theo Walcott scored in the first minute. Do you remember? And then
I do.
It was just like, oh God.
It was real back to basic stuff, wasn't it?
We
sort of completely changed the face of the team, mixed up the defence, became very pragmatic mm-hmm. in the way that we played and particularly the way we defended, and sort of managed to get over the line.
Yeah. The question was, though, do you think this has any influence on how Arteta is telling his team to go out at this moment in time in these big games? Sort of back to basics to an extent in terms of, you might be missing something in terms of performance, but what you've got to do when it comes to effort and endeavour in these games, you can't let that drop for a second because you'll get punished.
Yeah, I mean, we know a little bit about what's important to Arteta at this stage of the season because there was a photograph of Gabriel, wasn't there, in the dressing room with the word basics on a big poster on the wall behind him. Each of those letters in basics
from yesterday
different. But we don't. B and A are obscured by Gabriel's head, but shape, intensity, and compete.
Was that yesterday? For yesterday's game? I didn't see that, actually.
I believe so. Mm. I mean, you know, they do this every away game, as far as I'm aware. They,
yeah.
You know, put up these posters to make themselves feel more at home, away from home, which emphasise key messages. But basics is one of those key messages. Mm-hmm. To be fair to Arteta, I think it has been throughout his time. You know, even if you go back and watch All or Nothing, basics, it's up there with Jules in terms of how much he talks about it and emphasises mm-hmm. it. So, yeah, I'm sure his playing experience and that time at Arsenal informs him in that respect. He said he'd spoken with Arsene Wenger as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
In the build-up to this one, who knows a thing or two, I think, about being pragmatic in the final stages of the season, if it means, you know, winning a title or finishing a season unbeaten or securing Champions League qualification.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think the key thing is that at this point, performances aren't really that important. It's all about getting the points on the board and getting the results. And fortunately, we are still doing that. It's been an extraordinary run
yes.
in 2024.
Yeah, it really has.
Well, what about this? Speaking of kind of the title race, YM Archer on Discord says, "Goodly morning. Is Chris Wood the least potent Wood of all time? Did you see much of Nottingham Forest against Man City?"
Yeah.
I actually didn't watch it. I have seen some of the misses on social media. I was kind of doing the turning it off and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
That one.
I had it on when I was working.
I think I'm quite glad about that because I think if I'd been seeing those misses in real time, I think I would have been pretty inconsolable.
Yeah. Chris wouldn't, more like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say. I mean, is that game not an absolute example of just getting it over the line in a title race where City,
sure.
If you look at the XG in the game, I think Chris Wood himself had more XG than Man City, but they still win 2-0. So this is exactly what we're talking about. It's exactly what you need to do. And it also demonstrates the sort of the randomness of football because, you know, people will say this is the mark of champions and titles and experience for Manchester City. They've gone out, they've won a game where they weren't at their best. But if Chris Wood wasn't drunk or whatever, you know, they could have been 2-3-0 down in this game. And everyone's saying, well, they felt the pressure. Arsenal have put the pressure on them and Manchester City have bottled it. You know.
I mean, let me ask you this then. Do those chances that Chris Wood had give you hope?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe because I was looking at City's fixtures. They've obviously got Wolves on Saturday. Then they've got Fulham away. Then there's a midweek game where they go to Spurs away and West Ham on the final day. Listen, do not underestimate West Ham on the final day of a football season. They've been there. They've done that in the past. Let's, you know, did they, it was West Ham against Tottenham, wasn't it? Lasagna Gate.
Of course. When Yossi Benayoun.
Yossi Benayoun. But I remember as well, wasn't it the year that Blackburn won the league and Manchester United went to West Ham on the final day? And West Ham, I think they got battered, but somehow got a draw or won the game. I can't quite remember. But they denied Manchester United the title. So they've got some form in that regard. So even if it does go to the final day, West Ham, old David Moyes there, will do it for Mikel, his apprentice. And it'll all be fine.
I mean, the irony of all ironies, the game I'm really looking at is that one at Spurs.
Yeah. What do you think Spurs' approach to that will be? I mean, it might depend on what happens in their next game, whether or not Champions League football is still attainable for them. I mean, if they don't have the ability to go for a Champions League football, it's quite possible they will just take their foot off the gas and like go through the motions because that will be the Spursiest thing of all time, right? But if there is still a chance for them to qualify for the Champions League, to overtake Aston Villa, I watched Postecoglou before the game and he was talking about, well, you know, the question was something along the lines of, are you out to deny Arsenal the title? And he was like, well, you can't really think like that. We've got to do what we've got to do. And, you know, whether I think they're capable of doing it or you know, there's a measure of ineptitude to the way they approach certain games, I would rather they still had something to play for when they were facing Man City than not. Because that, I think, is the only way it would happen.
They've got a few games before them and they're not easy games. That's the thing. So later this week, they go to Chelsea. And then at the weekend, they go to Liverpool.
Oof.
Now, you know, I know Liverpool aren't in the best of form right now, but, you know, I think they've lost their last two league games. So it's not impossible. They could be on four consecutive defeats. Then they host Burnley and then they host Man City. So I guess we need them. I mean, I don't even like saying it, but we probably need them to get something out of these games this week.
Mm.
To keep their season alive, or we need Aston Villa to completely implode.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at their games now. What have they got? Brighton away on Sunday. Okay. And then Villa host Liverpool on Monday the 13th. Oof. So, yeah, it's all hard to call, isn't it, at this stage?
Yeah. I still think there's a twist in it somewhere.
There's a twist, potentially, but I still don't think we can afford a twist in our games.
No. Absolutely not. We've got to win our games and win all three to have a chance. So I'm hoping the twist obviously comes in the Man City side of things. What about this one? We talked about Havertz in the first half, but we had a couple of questions about him. Zach Taze on the Discord. Goodly fucking morning, gents. We expect Arsenal to enter the transfer window this summer looking for a new forward, but do we need to adjust what kind of profile we're looking for? Watching Havertz battle and win those flick-ons was a joy and makes me think he has the big man profile covered for us. Any thoughts on that? And then Non-Flying Dutchman said, a few weeks ago, I asked if there was anything Havertz could do between now and the end of the season to convince Arteta he should be our starting striker next season. Was that first half performance enough for you? If not, why not? So maybe you could have a go at both of those.
I think it's already changed the thinking a little bit at Arsenal based on, you know, what I've been hearing. And I think David Ornstein has also written about this, John Cross as well. I think that it was sort of assumed by many and felt even by many at Arsenal that a striker was a likelihood in the next transfer window. I think that Havertz's form has given some pause for thought there, and that it may be that other positions, you know, we've spoken about central midfield, are emerging as maybe more of a priority than anticipated. So I think already there's been a bit of a shift. I'm not saying Arsenal won't buy a striker, but I don't think we can take it as a given anymore. Or maybe if we do, it might affect the profile of striker, maybe the level of striker that we bring in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be someone to complement Havertz and add variety rather than someone who's coming in as a undisputed first choice. If it's down to me, James McNicholas, I'd still sign a striker. I think that Eddie Nketiah is almost certainly going to go. And I think that we would benefit from adding a different type of threat to what we've got. But maybe it'll be someone who can play wide as well. I don't know, to be honest. All I know is that I think priorities have shifted in the last few months, and Kai Havertz' form up front has been a big part in that. I mean, what do you feel? Do you think he has it in him to lead the line for Arsenal from August to May next season?
I'm really encouraged by him, I have to say. I think there's something to this player that we didn't see at Chelsea that maybe people saw at Bayer Leverkusen. And we're getting that out of him again. I mean, I agree with you. I'd like to see a sign of forward, whether it is an out-and-out striker or somebody who can play across the forward line, which I think is probably more likely. And we've had the discussion before about the profile of player that we think it might be. Like all the stories about Osimhen and Tony and the Swedish guy who was at Coventry, Gyökeres, is that how you pronounce it?
Gyökeres, yeah.
You know, I just
I've got no idea how you pronounce it, to be honest, but that's how I would do it.
Yeah, just sort of randomly sort of go, and it sounds vaguely like his name. Apologies to any Swedish listeners. You know, those players are going to be very, very expensive, and I haven't ever thought that this was going to be the kind of striker signing we make. Where I think it's interesting is that I've often said to you, I think we are a bit 5'9" in attack, and we're not anymore. And Kai Havertz's form and ability is the reason why.
That's very true.
So that might influence the type of signing that we make, because, you know, it was never a case of like, right, let's just buy a big lump of a guy and stick him up front in the last 20 minutes if we need a goal. You know, that's not how it works. But I think we have seen the benefit of having somebody who can provide you an outlet at number nine. And to be fair, Gabriel Jesus did quite a bit of that in the first part of his Arsenal career. His ability to hold the ball up as a number nine, bring people into play, win aerial duels, despite the fact he isn't the biggest guy, was kind of a step forward for this team. But I think we've seen the benefit of this now with Havertz over the last 3 months, or certainly in 2024. I think what he's contributed to the team has been pretty much as important as anybody else. It's whether or not, you know, you think he can do that again and do it again and do it again, you know, season after season. To me, he looks integrated. He looks settled. He looks comfortable. He looks like he knows the role. He looks like he enjoys the role. And I think there's probably more to come from a player who's still only 24 years of age. So it wouldn't surprise me if in the summer, rather than signing a striker, we brought in a versatile forward who could play across the forward line, who maybe has some similarities with Jesus, maybe has some similarities with Havertz, and is maybe just somewhere in between.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a rich vein of form, probably one of the best of his career. And I suppose what we don't know yet is it a purple patch or is it something he can maintain?
Yeah.
It's hard because we're going to get to the summer and sort of have to make that call without necessarily having the kind of depth of evidence you would want. I think the thinking may be simply that, you know, let's say you can bring in one big signing every summer. Like, we made several big signings last summer, but, you know, Declan Rice was kind of the marquee player. I just wonder if Arsenal are thinking if they are going to make an addition like that, would it be better off in midfield than up front at this particular point in time? And I could see why they might be thinking in that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Havertz has given them something to think about. And, you know, maybe this is not what he was bought for precisely, but if he's delivering, and he's, you know, he is delivering consistently, you know, it might be a purple patch, but it might just be a player who is thriving and producing what, you know, many people thought he could do when he left Germany, you know, because he was so highly rated. So,
What about this question? So this is from Master Johnbury on Discord, and they say, "Goodly St. Tottenham's Day, everybody. I watched the highlights of the under-21s match when Jurrien Timber scored that beautiful goal, and I have to say, Ranieri really impressed me. What do you see as his prospects and path to the first team when we're this good? Is the loan market the only way?"
That's a really interesting question. I guess it really depends on you know, how Mikel Arteta sees him fit into his team. Where is the role for Ethan Nwaneri? Where is he going to play in this system under Mikel Arteta? Could he be, for example, a backup or an alternative to Martin Odegaard? Not quite sure. He's still so young as well, isn't he? Because, like, you could say, send him out on loan for a year. It probably will do him good. Let him develop. But he's still only... Is he just gone 17? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I wonder if they might keep him in-house next season and give him minutes. But look, like any young player, he's going to have to really, really work hard to get onto the bench for this team and really take his chances if and when he is given games, whether they're cup games or some European games. I don't know. The European games next season are a little bit different. There aren't likely to be dead rubbers in the same way in the Champions League, because this league system means that every game could matter in terms of where you end up and prize money. And so I don't know. It's a tough one. This is what happens when the standards get raised. It becomes much more difficult for young players to break through, but they seem very invested in him. I think he's probably physically ready in the way that Saka was when he made his breakthrough. He doesn't look out of place physically, which is often, you know, the one thing about a young player who might have a lot of talent, but are they physically ready? Who's a good example of this? Charlie Patino might be a good example, that there's obviously a talented player there, but physically did not look like he was at the right level, you know? So I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. It's hard to predict.
I think they're really happy with him and his development. And from the bits and pieces I hear, his contribution in training has been really impressive. They definitely see him as part of the plans for the future. I think you mentioned that Martin Odegaard position. I think, you know, it'd probably be too strong to say he's been earmarked for that, but certainly they, you know, they can envisage a future where that's where he might be involved. I tend to agree with you. I think he'll be around. I think he'll make some cup squads. I think he'll get off the bench here and there next season. I don't see him going out on loan yet. It might be something that's in his development plan at kind of 18, 19. But I think for now they want to keep him at London Colney. But, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you know, look at Cole Palmer, right? Couldn't make the breakthrough at Man City and they sold him. But they sold him having given him time in big games to show his talent and increase his profile and raise his price tag. And I'd like to think that even if Nwaneri doesn't make it Arsenal, you know, he will get that sort of exposure at some point.
Yeah. All right, let's do a couple of quick ones. I like this one from Simon King on Discord. Were you surprised that Ange didn't play Madison? Hey, I like that one. Where's the other one? I can't remember where it is, but I thought this was quite an interesting one from George Mackerness on Twitter. Is that George Mackenine? I loved Saka giving shit back to their fans yesterday. Would you say he needs this level of cockiness as a winger to reach another level next year?
Do I think he needs it? I'm not... To be honest, I think that he is an incredibly confident and self-assured individual. I just don't think that he expresses that outwardly, maybe in ways that are kind of legible to us, you know? Mm-hmm. But if you look at his career to date, if you look at the times that he's sort of stood up for himself on the pitch or taken responsibility on, I think there must be enormous reserves of self-belief behind that. But equally, I know what the question means in that the best players, you know, you think of Thierry Henry among others, do have that kind of swagger to their game. And I can see him adding that to what he's already got and it potentially taking him to another level. What do you think?
I think it's probably just a mark of maturity as much as anything. Like that video that we referenced in the first half is just very funny because these guys are giving him dog's abuse. He's standing there taking a corner. The ball goes in. They shut up. And he's like, all right, I heard you. I heard you, but look at what I did or look at what I helped do. And I like that. I don't think he's ever going to be... He doesn't strike me anyway as the kind of guy who's going to get carried away with himself and become arrogant and petulant. But I think, you know, when you're subject to abuse from the stands or people saying stuff about you and you deliver with the consistency that he delivers on the pitch, I think you're perfectly entitled to have a go back. And I think now the fact he's, what, 22, coming up on 23, he's just in a better position to do that. 17, 18, 19-year-old Bukayo Saka still feeling his way into the game. We could all see the quality, but now he's got the consistency season after season to be able to give a little bit back. And I think, I'm not saying it's hugely important. I don't think it is the most important thing, but I think it is important for a player of his stature to be able to sort of recognize that he is going to be the target for this kind of stuff. And, you know, when you get it, you know, football fans have to be able to take a bit back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always this idea that players shouldn't react. The players should somehow be above whatever the terrible things that fans are singing at them or saying about them. You know, I think it just demonstrates a real maturity from Saka that he's capable of compartmentalizing the abuse and turning that into end product motivation, whatever else. I really like that. I enjoyed that aspect of his response to that yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, he'll be 23 next season. He's not a baby anymore.
He's a star man, not a star boy.
Yeah. But yeah, listen, we love him, don't we? And I think that was a big moment for him yesterday, scoring that goal at Spurs. You know, in a title race, away from home,
mm-hmm.
in a derby, great goal. It's just another instance of him delivering on the big stage.
Didn't he score there last season too?
Forced an own goal, I think, technically.
Right, okay. Well, you know, he's causing them problems. He's causing them pain in their literal and metaphorical hearts. And is that not as much as we can ask from any Arsenal star?
I think it is.
All right. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Get this podcast out to you guys. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for listening. We'll have some stuff for you during the week. It's a quiet week at last. It's been hectic, helter-skelter, but we will have our Premier League preview or Premier League review podcast for you tomorrow over on Patreon if you want to join us for that. Patreon.com/Arsbog. For now, enjoy your basking in a North London derby win, despite the panics it gave us. We won 3 points. That's all that matters. And we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.